is State versus Schroeder. Justice Frydenberg is recused from this matter. Chief Judge Moore is sitting in his place. Ms. Newell, good morning to you.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the Court and opposing counsel, my name is Sarah Newell. I'm an attorney with the Nebraska Commission on Public Advocacy. I'm here representing Patrick Schroeder, who is technically the appellant in this matter. I say technically because, as this Court is aware, this is a mandatory appeal under Nebraska Revised Statute 29-25-25. Although I don't ordinarily waste time on facts, I'm going to give a little bit of a rundown here. Patrick Schroeder is a gentleman who was serving a life sentence for killing a farmer down in southeastern Nebraska. During the term of serving that sentence, he was placed with a gentleman who was about to be released from custody from the Department of Corrections in a single cell in the segregation unit of the Tecumseh State Correctional Center. Mr. Schroeder informed numerous staff members that they were not compatible. Mr. Schroeder informed the court and informed investigators that at some points the staff members would walk by the cell acknowledging that they weren't compatible and joke, "Hey, have you killed that guy yet?" Despite those kind of circumstances and despite Mr. Schroeder's efforts to try to have Mr. Berry removed from his cell, nothing was ever done. Mr. Schroeder ultimately ended up killing Mr. Berry in his cell, or in their cell, and the state has then since charged Mr. Schroeder with a subsequent murder, including an aggravating circumstance, 1A, alleging that he has been convicted of a prior homicide, essentially.
So what is the significance of the fact that he told prison officials that they were not compatible?
Well, the panel here found that that fact was not true, despite the fact that there was significant evidence in the PSI indicating that Mr. Schroeder had told multiple staff members. And I think the thing that is most specifically important about that is that there's an exchange where Schroeder's talking about how he found out that unit manager Athena Brown had left for the weekend by the time that case manager Helton had talked to other staff about having a bad feeling about the two being together in the same cell. I think that is important because it shows that Mr. Schroeder would not have known that that conversation had occurred between Helton and Brown, or Helton and other staff members, if Helton had not told him that Brown had left for the day.
I think perhaps the question, which I also was waiting for the answer, is this something to do with an aggravating circumstance, something to do with a mitigating circumstance, a statutory mitigator, a non-statutory mitigator? Why are we talking about it?
I would assert that it is a non-statutory mitigator. As the court is aware, under Lockett v. Ohio and the various U.S. Supreme Court precedents, the court and the panel can consider anything that is deemed relevant, anything that goes to the potential mitigation or goes to potential mitigation. In this case, Mr. Schroeder began with counsel. We were appointed to represent him. He had differences of opinion about how the case should proceed in terms of whether he wanted to wage a defense of any sort, and so we were converted to standby counsel. So he proceeded pro se at the plea, pled as charged to all charges, no plea agreement whatsoever, and also had his proceeded pro se at the aggravation mitigation proportionality hearing. That is significant because there is, I think, a tension in the statutes, in the Nebraska statutes, about what the role of counsel in my position is. I am obviously here for the purposes of direct appeal and direct review to ensure the reliability of the proceedings. However, I am hampered by the record that my client has presented. Most of our appellate procedures, as this court is well aware, are based on the idea of waiver, the waiver doctrine, that if you don't present the argument at the time of trial, that you don't then get to argue it at the time of appeal. So I'm in the position of having to scour the record for creative arguments to try to find ways to raise the issues that could have been presented had he proceeded with counsel. So I would submit to you that that factor is a non-statutory mitigator that the court had before it, or the panel had before it, and should have considered. Obviously, it did not. The failure to consider a non-statutory mitigator, if this court on its de novo review agrees with me, is that that is not harmless error, because you cannot determine, you can't reweigh if you didn't know that that factor was
in existence.
Why is it mitigating? I think that it is mitigating because in this circumstance, Mr. Schroeder is trapped in this cell with this person who he does not like, he does not want to be celled with. I think that there are potential arguments also that maybe that was an intentional decision on the part of the Department of Corrections. You don't have a lot in the record to go off of that. Again, you're bound with what you have. But I think that that goes into this kind of idea of why he felt he had no other options, why it could go to a potential statutory mitigator if there was sufficient evidence flushed out in terms of mitigation about whether he was under extreme emotional disturbance or extreme or unusual pressure. Those kind of things could have been argued to bolster if he would have cooperated with a psychiatric evaluation. Perhaps even documentation from the Department of Corrections records, which we know exists because they were turned over in the discovery responses, but were not included in the PSI. There's all kinds of information in there that could have supported this kind of argument if Mr. Schroeder had been inclined to present it.
So what exactly was the role of standby counsel during the aggravation mitigation phase?
To stand there or sit there and answer questions if he had any. Mr. Schroeder was very clear with us about what role he wanted us to serve and what his intentions were in proceeding with the litigation. I don't know that I can go into all of that.
Asking you to go into it. I'm just asking, as a practical matter, what was the role of counsel during that
proceeding? Casually to sit there and look pretty and be ready in case he decided he wanted to present mitigating evidence. We did have mitigating evidence ready to go, at least some of the things that we would have been able to present just on documentation. Mr. Schroeder elected to basically just sit there and let the train hit him. And so that is essentially what standby counsel was relegated to doing. I was able to argue that his restraints should be removed. That was the one thing that he allowed us to do. Moving forward...
Let me stick with that only a little bit. Was it error to permit him to go on his own behalf?
I don't think that there's anything in the record to support the idea that he was not competent to make the decision to waive counsel. I think that is, therein lies the rub. I mean, we are in a situation where under Feretta, he has the ability to represent himself, and under McCoy, we are not able to dictate certain, we're not able to dictate whether he's going to plead and whether he's going to proceed with presenting mitigating evidence and things like that. So in that face
with the record would show he understood what's going on. And the significance of it.
There's nothing in the record that suggests that he didn't, that there was a competency issue. He answered all the questions correctly. There wasn't a full-blown psychiatric evaluation, but there also wasn't one requested, if that answers your question.
Okay, thank you.
In addition to, I guess the problem with this volunteering aspect is, and I spent a lot of time on this in my brief, and I don't really want to belabor it here because I don't think it's my strongest argument. But there is an argument that there is a question about whether the death penalty proceedings in Nebraska are unconstitutional as applied to Mr. Schroeder, because all of the different procedural mechanisms that we have in place to maintain the integrity of the process have effectively been undermined by Mr. Schroeder's efforts. I'm not going to talk about Palmer. I mean, I argued in the brief that it should be overruled. I obviously don't get to argue that because it wasn't argued below. I didn't assign it as error. Those are some of the problems with the waiver doctrine in terms of appellate review. Although you have a direct appellate review requirement, it's essentially meaningless because I'm bound by what my client has presented. In terms of proportionality, you're, again, only seeing the cases that this court has decided are relevant, and that is other cases in which the death penalty was imposed. I think that the court's analysis, the panel's analysis in terms of the proportionality decision, kind of demonstrates some of the problems with that, because one of the cases that they relied on is State versus Jones from 1982 that was ultimately reversed. And actually, Mr. Jones had more aggravators alleged initially than Mr. Schroeder has. Mr. Schroeder only has the one. And yet Mr. Jones's case was reversed because the evidence upon which his prior conviction relied upon, there was a legal issue, and so that was thrown out, and then upon reweighing and balancing, the court ultimately determined that the death penalty was not appropriate. So in comparing those two, you see the problems with the proportionality analysis. Also, if you look at Mr. Schroeder's prior murder, I think the facts of the prior murder where a death penalty was not alleged are actually arguably more egregious than the facts of the current murder. Again, that's sort of the problem with the proportionality analysis. I only say that because when you have multiple procedures in place and those procedures are seemingly not working or are capable of being thwarted by a volunteering defendant, I think that puts into question whether there are problems with the system more broadly. I know the state responds to that by citing Blystone versus Pennsylvania. I would acknowledge that Blystone versus Pennsylvania is a U.S. Supreme Court case where the Supreme Court basically ratified on an as-applied challenge a procedure that is less restrictive or has fewer procedural protections than ours. The one thing I would distinguish about Blystone is that in Blystone, the defendant actually, although he refused to waive mitigators, he was represented by counsel. And there have been subsequent U.S. Supreme Court opinions that have suggested that had Mr. Schroeder continued with us representing him and we did not sufficiently investigate mitigating circumstances, that could be the basis for ineffective assistance of counsel. So the fact that Mr. Blystone did have counsel and that counsel agreed or acquiesced to Mr. Blystone's requirements not to present mitigating evidence is, I think, somewhat distinct.
So are you arguing that there should be an exception to Feretta? And if so, how do we go about doing that?
As I indicated in the brief, I'm not arguing that there should be an exception to Feretta. I think that's just a quagmire that's not necessary. And I think it also undermines the Sixth Amendment right to represent yourself. What I did argue in the brief is that there should be or there can be, this court could construe the statutes to provide a guardian ad litem type of role for either as standby counsel or a separate investigatory purpose. That could also be served by strengthening or making sure that the trial court is having the PSI conducted in a way that is consistent with statute and getting all the information available. There are other courts that have interpreted their statutes as allowing that kind of investigatory role. Florida is one of them. I think the amicus brief mentioned Muhammad versus State. Georgia is another state that at least the Supreme Court has allowed that kind of investigatory effort by the trial court when a defendant refused to present mitigators.
Do those states have specific statutes that authorize that?
As I read them, the statutes didn't specifically authorize it. It was more of their Supreme Court taking Lockett and other precedents and deciding that was what was required under their provisions. I don't know that those statutes are, I mean, obviously they're from other states, they're not binding here. I suggest those as a way of suggesting a potential remedy for this issue.
So are you asking, is there language in our existing statutes that you would tie this to in some fashion, or are you asking us to just, for lack of a better term, make it up?
I think that there's an argument that you could use the PSI statutes. Let's see if I can find the number. I think it's specifically,
in the homicide statute or in the PSI statute?
Yes, I want to say 292261, because it references the various requirements that should be included in the PSI. Obviously, it would be better if this were remedied by the legislature. However, the legislature is in a weird position as well because they recently repealed the death penalty, which was then reinstated by a vote of the people. So,
is the quagmire somebody's competent but foolish?
Well, I mean, I think
and
that's
what would be the government or the state's role to,
I think the argument
that, if any.
I'm sorry, yeah. Cutting off. I think the argument is that in a death penalty case, because of the seriousness of the consequences, that the state and the court have a more intensified role in supervising the reliability of the process. And so to the extent that this court determines that is something that exists, it is specific to this procedure because of the seriousness of the consequences. I would submit to you that you don't have to go that far. I think that if you look at the court's rulings here, the panel's rulings here, you can reverse on the panel's rulings alone. Specifically, the primary issue I think that exists here is that the panel allowed the state to introduce evidence regarding to rebut statutory mitigators, and in doing so, they did that even though Mr. Schroeder presented no mitigating evidence. So traditionally, we understand the idea of rebutting evidence to be in response to something the other party did. Here, the other party presented nothing. So here, the state went kind of out on its own to determine that it needed to rebut the statutory mitigators by presenting evidence which, if you look at it critically, very minimally touches on the statutory mitigators. The evidence actually, if you look at it closely, looks like it's proving either non-statutory aggravators in the form of future dangerousness, or it looks like it is addressing 1D, which is not an alleged aggravator, in terms of the idea of heinous, atrocious, and cruel, and exceptional depravity. It talks about, the evidence specifically emphasized repeatedly that Mr. Schroeder was in segregation. They introduced a letter from Mr. Schroeder saying that he would kill again if he was put back in a cell with anyone else. Those things, I think, go to the future dangerousness. The state also argued that Mr. Schroeder had a minimal regard for human life, as did the defendants in the other cases to which it compared proportionality, where 1D and other things were found. So I think that kind of an argument is you can reach on plain error, and I think you can address those issues. The flip side of that, and I know I'm in my rebuttal time, I said I wasn't going to do this, but I always do. The flip side of that is that in the state's, or in the court's proportionality analysis, you can also see certain language coming through that demonstrates that they did in fact consider future dangerousness, and they did in fact consider factors under 1D, like whether it was heinous, atrocious, or cruel, and exhibited exceptional depravity. Specifically, they said things like that Mr. Schroeder knew full well that Barry was a week away from his release, and that his refusing to ask Barry to move meant that he demonstrated a premeditative and depraved mentality. Depraved is part of the language under heinous, atrocious, and cruel, and under 1D. Also indicated repeatedly that he evidenced no remorse, that he's disinclined to change, that his behavior was disturbing in its own right, and especially cruel. Cruelty, again, are the languages of 1D. These are the factors that that go into factors that were not pled, and that is problematic because the statute specifically says if you're going to consider an aggravator, it has to be pled. You have to prove it beyond a reasonable doubt. And also the rules of evidence apply at the aggravation hearing. So with the state kind of backdooring this evidence in under the guise of rebutting mitigating evidence, it was able to obviate the requirements for pleading the statutory aggravators, and obviously non-statutory aggravators are not relevant, but and also obviate the requirement that be proven beyond a reasonable doubt. I will try to preserve whatever time I have remaining.
Thank you very much. Mr. Smith, good morning to you.
Good morning.
James D. Smith, Solicitor General, appearing for the appellant state of Nebraska. I'd like to start off my argument by complimenting publicly the Commission on Public Advocacy for their service in this case. This is an automatic death penalty appeal. Mr. Schroeder himself did not file a notice of appeal. We were presented with a situation in which Mr. Schroeder potentially could have simply defaulted in filing a brief without counsel, and there's really no mechanism in place for determining, appellate court can't really determine whether Mr. Schroeder had waived counsel for appeal. So what happened is the commission and I communicated with each other and decided to jointly apply to this court for appointment of counsel. This court at least directed us with that motion to make a similar, or at least refer the matter back to the trial court. Council on Public Advocacy communicated with Mr. Schroeder, who decided he did want to have counsel for appeal, so we made a joint motion in the district court for appointment of counsel, specifically the commission. Commission accepted the appointment, and they were appointed. These death penalty cases, we do not have what I'd call a big volume of attorneys that are competent, qualified, and experienced in handling death penalty cases. It's primarily the commission, and depending on what part of the state you're in, selected attorneys. So their service has been appreciated. I do understand their arguments, and I do understand the purpose why they make them. As far as the issues on...
Actually, to both of you.
Oh, thank you, Your Honor. Issue of why the victim was placed in Mr. Schroeder's cell, why he ended up not being removed from the cell sooner, I would just call the court's attention to the transcript, the trial court's sentencing order at 234 to 235 of the transcript lays out the facts on how the victim ended up being placed in Mr. Schroeder's cell. In other words, Mr. Schroeder was asked if he would be willing to accept another cellmate. He did agree to that, and the victim was then placed in Mr. Schroeder's cell, I believe, on April 10th. It was 5 days.
What is the significance or importance of the fact that he agreed to have a cellmate? I take it not specifically the victim.
To me, it comes under the category of whether a court would consider the placement of the victim in the cell with the person who's previously committed first-degree murder, and the fact that how that person victim got placed in the cell, as far as whether the court would want to consider that as a non-statutory mitigating factor. It's not a statutory mitigating factor, but I think the court has great latitude on non-statutory mitigating factors. The trial court did not find this to be a non-statutory mitigating factor under the law. The review by this court of mitigating circumstances is a de novo review, which would indicate that the court can make its own independent judgment as far as whether the victim's placement in the cell, why he was still in the cell, whether he should have been removed, whether that's a non-statutory mitigating factor by de novo review. I would point the court to transcript page 241 of the court sentencing order, in which the trial court, at least the panel, found that the defendant did not ask to have the victim be moved, and there is evidence in the record reflecting that Mr. Schroeder may have decided shortly after the victim was placed in the cell that he was going to kill him. A period of days go by, and at least the trial panel found that Mr. Berry did not request or tell the guards that he was in mortal danger, or the victim was in mortal danger if he was not moved. I think those are subject to de novo review.
And when did that evidence come in?
That evidence would have came in, it would have came in as part of the sentencing hearing. It wouldn't have, as I recall, it doesn't come in at the aggravating. It comes in at the mitigating phase.
Is that the rebuttal testimony that the appellant's talking about?
Well, it's actually non-mitigating evidence that comes in that the state presented, because under the statute, the court is free to consider any evidence on sentence excessiveness, disproportionality, or mitigating evidence. It's pretty wide open as to the trial court's ability just to receive that type of evidence. And the court
counsel is concerned about no mitigating evidence being offered by the appellant, and then the state then offering the term rebuttal mitigating evidence during the sentencing hearing. What's your argument in regard to that?
The argument is, under the statute, the state is free to present any evidence that may be relevant to the issue of excessiveness of sentence or mitigation. So whether or not the defendant elects to present anything under the statute, the state is still free to do so. And the state, when it offered the evidence, stated that it was offering it for the purpose of showing the statute. Not the statutory mitigating factors did not apply. That was the basis on which the trial court received it.
I think that I heard the argument from Ms. Newell to the effect that this evidence came in that went to 1D, was 1D charged as an aggravator.
And that when the evidence was presented, and I have it cited in my brief, the prosecutor gave a statement as to the purpose, the relevance, probative value on why that evidence was being offered. So I think the
Which was what? It was probative of what?
Non-existence of mitigating circumstances, specifically statutory mitigating circumstances.
Non-existence of mitigator. Not evidence to support a charged or an uncharged aggravator.
That is correct.
Okay.
Yeah. State did not say we're offering this to prove aggravating circumstances. The state characterized it that it was offering it to prove the non-existence of mitigating circumstances.
That may have been where Justice Funk was going.
That's why I took it. So.
Otherwise,
I think the case has been sufficiently briefed, at least from our side, from what I heard from the argument today. I don't know if the court has other questions.
Ms. Newell seemed to offer a proposal to tackle the conundrum of self-represented individuals in death penalty cases. What is your take on that?
My take on that is that would be unconstitutional. Not only be unconstitutional, it's not provided for by statute. If the legislature wanted to set up a death penalty procedure that would provide for some type of a pseudo guardian ad litem, it could do so. It hasn't done so. And I think the defendant also has the right to choose the course of his defense constitutionally. He also has the constitutional right to represent himself. He did so. The district court, upon inquiry, found that the choice to represent himself was made knowingly, intentionally, voluntarily. And so that is his constitutional right. My conclusion would be is what counsel is suggesting is essentially violating the Constitution in a death penalty case. And there is no U.S. Supreme Court precedent to allow that.
The premise of that would be if the guardian were appointed over the defendant's objection.
Well, I think if the guardian, there's no procedure set up to appoint a guardian.
Constitutionally,
if one was appointed, then the issue is what's that person's authority? And then if it's over the defendant's objection, I would submit that that is unconstitutional. It's also inconsistent, at least in the facts of this case, of what the defendant's choice was. He wanted to represent himself.
And I realize we don't have it here, but just if the procedure did exist and there was an appointment to which the defendant did not object but did not consent, how would that interface with Beretta, if at all?
I think I would want to analyze that further before I would answer, because it wasn't raised by the other side.
Okay.
Counsel, does the three-judge panel have a statutory or constitutional obligation to seek out additional evidence, such as prison records or mental health records, things of that nature, through the pre-sentence investigation?
No, they don't. There's just no authority for the court on its own to essentially be an independent investigator, and constitutionally it's essentially the court can't prohibit the ability of a defendant to present mitigating evidence. That didn't happen in this case. If there's nothing further, we would ask that the judgment of the district court be affirmed.
Thank you very much. Do we have time for rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor. 2 minutes and 39 seconds.
2 minutes and 39 seconds, Ms. Newell.
Thank you, Your Honor. Returning to the issue of the rebuttal testimony, in terms of what the state argued, the evidence that was presented was testimony from Officer Stacy Lundgren, who also had an interview with the defendant, and then the interview was introduced. Also, multiple officers that came on the scene that talked about him being in segregation, and a letter that he had written asking to proceed pro se, in which he specifically said, if you put me back in there, I'm going to kill again. So again, that goes to future dangerousness. I see no relevance whatsoever to that letter but for the future dangerousness issue. Also, if you look at counsel's arguments, the state's arguments with regard to the actual rebuttal of the statutory mitigators, he walks through each mitigator and talks about how there wasn't any evidence to support them, but there's little to no tie back to the evidence that was presented in rebuttal. So it looks more like the evidence that was presented in rebuttal was really more evidence that should have been presented in aggravation. And if you look at the court's ruling in terms of the factual determination, almost all of the evidence in the factual determination came from the rebuttal evidence. And the court's order specifically says that much of the factual recitation came from the interview with Stacy Lundgren, who was explicitly presented in rebuttal. So if you look at that, plus if you look at the court's analysis in terms of the way they actually analyzed the proportionality considerations, they're looking at, aside from Dunster, they compared other cases that had the 1A, but also that had 1D, multiple homicides plus the heinous, atrocious, and cruel or exceptional depravity type language from 1D. But each of those factors, or each of the cases that they compared with, even Dunster, presented much more significant facts, much more egregious facts than were presented in this case. So we would submit that even though the court didn't say that it was considering non-statutory aggravators in the form of future dangerousness, and even though it didn't say that it was taking into consideration unpled aggravators under 1D, the analysis certainly looks like it did.
Does the analysis suggest Dunster was factually more relevant?
It does. And it is very true that this court has said multiple times that there is no, you can't color match these cases. What I would tell you is
that the factual matter of the crime on deck
is the most similar. Dunster is also, if I may,
You may.
Dunster is also dissimilar in the sense that there were two prior homicides. One was a murder for hire that also involved a sexual assault, probably, and the other was a murder of another cellmate before he killed the cellmate involved here. So Dunster is another individual who refused to present mitigating evidence, but again, the facts involved there are more egregious. And I would submit to you that Dunster kind of also demonstrates the problem with the way that our volunteers can skew the proportionality analysis. Because aside from Dunster, there really aren't that many other cases. I think maybe just one, Mata. In my brief I said there was only one, but I think Mata also technically only had one aggravator, but it was perhaps multiple findings of 1D. Mata's the gentleman that cut up the girlfriend's son and fed him to the dog. So there's potentially mutilation, there's heinous, atrocious, and cruel, and relishing because he fed the child to the dog specifically to get back at her. So there's potentially more facets or stronger elements to 1D there than there is here. So thank you, Your Honors. I would ask you to reverse the decision and find this not harmless error.
Thank you very much, and thank you for your service. The next case of the day, then, is State versus Ildefonso. Justice Frydenberg is recused in this case also. Chief Judge Moore, however, is not participating.